testing. We're testing.
I think we're good. Look at that. Well,
that there's a first. Okay. Yeah. That's a first. And I'm going to take that kind of energy on a Thursday.
Cool. So let's go right into it. Who are you?
My name's Ben. I'm also known as the Box Dad on social media and TikTok. I'm the owner of Box Painting, founder of Box Foundation, outdoor enthusiast and father of two.
What the hell's going on here? What are we doing?
What do you mean?
What are we doing here?
Oh, like today? The episode? This
is
the how-to podcast with Luke and Ben.
That's right.
I'm Ben. That's Luke. Don't hit me with that. You normally do the intro.
You said you were bringing the energy, bringing the funk.
So first, I have absolutely nothing in particular to discuss today, but I am in a good vibe energy today. And there's no particular reason for it. It's probably the changing of the season.
Ooh.
Autumn is my vibe. Yeah. It really is. And I think the other thing too, is because autumn is my vibe. I mean, for those that don't know, I have a whole tattoo that's just autumn themed.
Oh, I did not know that.
You didn't know?
Yeah, that's all autumn themed. Yeah. I know that you have the tattoo, but you haven't gone through welcome to fall. Yeah. I haven't dissected the meaning of it.
Really? Oh,
when would we have done that? Who take my shirt off and show you my sleeve? This represents September. This moves into October. This is Halloween. And here's Thanksgiving dinner. This is got an elk. What do you mean? Like you and I have sat there and dissected your tattoo. First thing, Ben, great to meet you. Tell me about the meaning of your tattoo. When did we do that?
We have not.
I know, but you said like, how do you not know this about me?
This is going to be a good episode. I can feel it. And we're going to have fun.
Here's Peyton Manning as a fawn.
So here's the thing though. So we talked last episode, right? I get a little cynical about people celebrating the season of pumpkins a little early.
The pumpkin spice.
Yeah. Like what are we doing in all it was August last time and I'm not about that energy. So I get this cynicism because it's still warm out, but now you look outside, fall is arriving. The leaves are changing.
Yep.
The air temperature is cooled. I believe we kind of had this last weekend, our last 100-degree day for the remainder of the summer. I think that, you know, maybe we get into something in the 80, upper 80s and 90s, but we ain't going to hit 100 again. I bet money.
Hope not. We had enough of them. It's official. So here's the weird thing is it feels like fall is always the earliest to change.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think it has more to do. What's that?
Oh, I was going to say spring takes its time to come around. Like spring always takes its
time. Yeah, but but it's not the weather. I think what is that like slams fall into your face is football. Mm-hmm. It's football. Yeah. There's just such because spring is baseball. And nobody's like, it's game one. Everything's on the line. It's like in the springtime.
We dim boys.
Yeah, it's like springtime. It's like, all right, well, they're reporting to spring training and you're like, yeah, in Arizona. And then you're like, cool, they're in Florida and Arizona. Like nobody's coming to spring training in the Pacific Northwest. And we don't even have like in Portland, there is no football. There's Portland State that nobody cares about. This weekend, the Beavs are coming up to play Montana State.
At their stadium, right?
Well, no, at Providence Park.
But Providence, that's what I meant.
At the soccer stadium.
But
the NFL hits you like a sledgehammer. Like, dude, the from last Thursday through Monday, you're just... nice tie, by the way, Colts. Just tie the freaking Texans.
Hey, you know what?
I worked hard to tie the Texans too.
Yeah, we worked hard. Like
well earned.
for those of you who don't know, me and my ex, Hannah, we are Indianapolis Colts fanatics, right? And we're still on very great terms when it comes to discussion of football.
Football.
And
I like
and,
that those are the only terms you're good on.
No. We are in good terms on all things, but in particular, like,
can I just squeeze something in here? Well, because I'm sure that you have something wonderful to say about your ex-wife here. I just don't want to lose this train of thought. This is for all of you listeners right now. He and his ex-wife, fans of the same football team, me and my still wife, bitter rivals. I'm Seahawks. She's 49ers. So if you think you have to get along with everything, you're much better off having something as silly and stupid as sports to fight about, because then it takes the tension off of everything else. We've got 49ers Seahawks week 2 coming up this week, and we're going to be at her family's house. And there's probably going to be some slap fighting going on. It's going to get ugly, but you know what? Yeah. We'll be better for it.
And let's be real. The Seahawks, that was a good game.
It's a great game. It wasn't like a great, well-played game necessarily. Second half, but as far as entertainment value, it gets no better than that. That was awesome.
Yeah, win is a win. Yeah. Okay, so we are diehard Colts fans. And the one thing that Hannah and I still text about today is football.
Kids.
It's
football.
It's football season. It's football season. So I'm on my way back.
Pick up a goddamn third down. Oh, by the way, one of the kids has cholera. Like, don't worry about that.
I'm on my way back from a trip with my father this last weekend. And I'm like, as we're driving, I've got the like fantasy cast, you know, where they have the little ball that moves back and forth on the fake field that you can see when they, and then it just tells you to play.
Yeah, it's like, a game cast. It's not the fantasy cast.
Whatever. I don't know what they call it.
Yeah, well, it's game cast. But fantasy cast would be like, this wide receiver has this many points in your fantasy league. Fantasy football is stupid. And we move on from that.
Harsh.
Okay.
Harsh word.
Okay.
So anyway, at the end of this, Hannah and I are texting, and I was like, how do we end this in a tie? Like, and the first thing she said is, she goes, we were lucky to end it in a tie. That was a shit show. Just as you said, like, she was so disappointed. I mean, just with all the hype, you have the number one, I mean, arguably the number one running back.
Yep.
And who had a decent game, mm-hmm. 165 yards, a touchdown, I think 30 some odd carries. Why can't we? And the defense held.
You're playing against the freaking Texans.
The Texans and David Mills. It was disappointing and disheartening.
Davis Mills.
And I think the other thing too, Dave. Oh, thank you. Davis, David.
No, so don't just whatever his name. Jeez.
Whatever.
Barney. Yeah,
here's the thing.
I'm a Barney, man.
This is what bothered me the most about the game. It was if you take the end of our season last year where we lose the last two games.
To Jacksonville, one of them.
In Jacksonville is one of them. And then you pair that with a tie to start the regular season.
And you changed quarterbacks.
And we changed quarterback and made good up. I think we made good upgrades at defense. I think and a couple of offensive. I better see a whole heck of a lot better. And I do believe that Frank Reich is on the hot seat this year as a head coach. I think that if it's not minimum a playoff berth, but even I think he needs to win a playoff game or two to keep his job.
Their roster's too good.
Yeah, their roster's too good. And what I think sucks is that I believe our GM, Chris Ballard, is excellent. But unfortunately, he is tied to Frank Reich in his performance. Yep. And it is very possible that we could lose a quality GM. Like, I believe he's a quality GM because of this pairing. And that's really unfortunate.
Well, the good news is you have a rational, level-headed owner. So I think you'll be fine. No? Nothing?
Just crickets.
Shimmer say no? Doesn't fit that bill. All right. So walk me through this this fall tattoo. What do you get? What's going on?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
I can
so
I can see it now.
Now we're going to, when we talk about the tattoo, the first thing you need to know is that the former best friend that I had taken a picture.
Former, like,
super drama, like 30 plus years of friendship gone, right? Like that, no contact, just we were done being friends. Whoa. Now, the beginning of the tattoo began prior to our ultimate demise as friends, right?
Sure.
But he took this picture that would basically begin the process of the full sleeve tattoo.
Okay.
The other thing to know is my experience doing a full sleeve tattoo is, I think, different than a lot of people. I think that a lot of people will enter into the concept that they're going to get a full sleeve tattoo and have a lot of input on how it's going to be, where it's going to be, and what's going to go on. So I do my research, you know, in the lead up to getting the tattoo, and I found a guy named Dellen. And for those of you who want to go take a look at the guy's work, it is called, his IG is Tattoos by Dellen.
Dellen?
Yeah, D-E-L-A-N. Okay. Dellen Canclini. He was in Salem, and he now moved to Georgia. Okay. So if I want to get my other half sleeve done, I'd have to go, and I would go do it, have it done by him for sure, but I'd have to travel. So I figure out that this is the guy I want to do through, you know, looking at pictures.
Can we cut out?
Yeah.
This is the guy I want to do.
No, just as we need to edit that. This is the guy that I want to go have work on.
This is the artist I would like to work with.
Thank you. This is the artist that I want to work with.
Guy I'd like to do.
Yeah, that came out way, way wrong.
Hey, I don't know what your relationship is. Is this why your friend stopped being your friend?
Not at all.
Is he homophobic? about your relationship with Dellen?
I go to like the studio, right?
Yeah.
And I say, hi, my name's Ben, you know, yada, yada, yada. And he's working on something. I was like, this is what I'm looking at doing. I'm looking at doing a full sleeve. And I want to have one artist do the entire thing.
Yep.
That was my number one goal, was one artist that I found that I could trust that would do the whole thing. And I gave him the concept of the picture, right, that I was going after. And I said, this is kind of what I'm thinking. And then he stopped me. He goes, okay, just so you know, I appreciate everything you want to do here. And those things, these elements can be implicated in the tattoo. But know that the way that this works for me is, you give me ideas, I just imagine it based on the story that you tell me. And then I put it on your body. And so each session, there were four sessions. Each one took somewhere between 4.5 to 5.5 hours.
Damn.
So about almost 24 hours of total work. Yep. It was a good amount. And the way it would work is, I would say, okay, Dellen, I want to have 7 trees that represent X. I want to have
this. Whoa, slow down. What do they represent? If you've got this all in your head. So you're explaining that this is now the How to Fall podcast.
How to fall?
Because it's to double meaning.
So the tattoo begins here, right? So we'll start here. The front. This is the front of my forearm, and in particular, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of these types of trees that move right here. These represent the larch or the tamarack, which is a high alpine fir tree.
Okay.
The uniqueness of the tamarack or larch is that it's needles. They turn yellow and they actually fall off. They are a evergreen tree, but they actually lose their needles like a deciduous tree.
So wait. Really, it wouldn't be evergreen. It's like a conifer.
Keep me going.
It's a good thing I'm here.
Yeah, absolutely, it's good. So each of those trees represents a member of my family, to include Hannah, right? These are what I would, mother, father, sister, brother, what I would call front end support, right? Like as you're going through your life, they are a major part of your life.
Okay.
Then, so the interesting part is that you see the dog here on the.
I do see the dog. Now people are listening to this, so they do not.
Yeah, So, and if for those of you that follow me on social media, you can look at my arm. I have done TikToks that explain the tattoo. But so the dog is Ori. Ori passed away in 2018, but the picture was taken, I believe, in 2015 or 2016. And the picture that it is was taken by my former best friend. And it was probably from about 100 yards away in Central Oregon. And we were bird hunting in the snow. And it's just this cascade landscape of snow. And the dog is running back to me. My dog is running back to me. And there's this mountain hillside that's also covered in snow in Central Oregon as we're hunting upland birds. So that's kind of the start of the scene, right? Is where you have these mountains. But in particular, you'll notice that there's also trees. In the picture that I have that was taken by my friend, there were no trees because it's Central Oregon. So just big open landscapes.
High desert.
Yeah, high desert. Exactly. So the trees I added, but these trees right here, this series of trees, right, in the in the foreground or background, thank you. Those trees represent what I would call secondary support people of my life. In particular, I mean, I can name a good handful of them. These are the people that were my scout masters growing up in Boy Scouts. These are
how far did you go in Boy Scouts? Were you an Eagle Scout?
I am an Eagle Scout. Yeah. Well, like my other tattoo across my back is on my honor. It's the first three words of the scout oath. Oops. So yeah. Oh yeah. It's a whole thing. it's a whole thing. So this first part right here on the forearm was the first part of the 4-part series.
Yep.
And it begins with Ori running. And when you flip it over, right, the next part is on the inside here is Indy. So Indy is looking toward Ori, right?
Yep.
And the reason that this is important is because Ori would pass away in 2018, and Indy, my now chocolate lab that I've had since 17, they were best friends for that year that Ori and Indy were together. Two chocolate labs, no doubt about it, that this dog learned to hunt from Ori. And the morning that Ori would pass, it was July 31st, the night before was a Sunday night, and Ori had a rough day. She was 12 years old and she was just having a rough day, meaning that she, in particular, her hips weren't working real well that day. She was just real rough. And so I didn't
want her. How old?
12. Okay. She was 12. Yeah. So I didn't want her to walk up the stairs that night to come to bed. So I put a baby gate up and I had her stay downstairs. And Hannah woke up that morning and went to work or went to the gym first. And I woke up after her to go to the gym second, because then we rotate for the kids. Yeah. Exactly. And at 5:30, when I came down, as I went down and saw that she did not raise her head to see that I was there, I knew that something was not good. Like so I get the baby gate off and I go, and she's laying there on the ground just as she would. And I put my hand on her chest and she was still warm, but she was gone.
Yep.
She was gone. And the fascinating part was that Indy did not come down with either Hannah or me that morning.
Normally she would.
Oh, she would bolt downstairs, ready for food, ready to go outside, right? Like, it's morning time. We got to get this day going. And as soon as I felt Ori, I called Hannah or text her and said, hey, Ori's passed. Hannah immediately comes home. And the gym was only like 5 minutes away. And so Hannah gets home. And as Hannah gets home, I had moved Ori out to a picnic table that was on our back in our backyard.
Yeah.
And as Hannah gets home, and once Ori was outside, that was when Indy came down. The first thing Indy did was she's smelling the spot where Ori had passed, right? Very, very emotional. And then she goes over to the picnic table that's outside and is smelling, like she gets up on the seat and she's smelling Ori. And we have our moments, you know, all those things. But for the next week and a half, almost 2 weeks, Indy would go outside for about 30 to 45 minutes a day and sit just like this on top of the table where this dog had laid, had she had seen her friend last, and just look.
Just stare off in the distance.
Just stare off in the distance. And I'm gonna get emotional just talking about
Special emotional episode of the podcast.
So that right there, right? Whether it was her looking for her friend and me now going through the process of losing a friend, right? I named the tattoo "Looking for a Friend."
Ah, right? There you go.
That was this whole tie-in. So Indy is looking, right, toward Ori. And I have many photos where I've taken Ori's ashes and Indy is, you know, looking in the mountains, yada, yada, yada. The other elements of the tattoo is you move up the tattoo, right? So
towards the elbow.
Yeah. So again, we have the same trees here with the negative image for leaves that are falling. But then you get to the back of my forearm. The back of the forearm has a massive maple tree moving all the way up the arm. And it goes all the way to the crest of the shoulder blade itself. That tree in 2019 on a trip with my father that my former friend was supposed to be on. My father and I, we did a trip to Montana to do a deer hunting trip. And I have a picture of a tree that I took of my father that he's standing next to. It's this very large boxwood maple. The fascinating part about the tree is that my personal bet is that the tree is old enough that it saw Lewis and Clark come up this part of the Montana, up the Missouri River. Mm. Like, I felt like this tree was that old. It, like, to give you context, this tree was super cool. It's super big and it's in full yellow autumn color.
Yeah.
It's a boxwood maple, which is a cousin of our standard maple that we have here.
Yeah.
So I take a picture of this tree and I tell Dylan, I was like, I want this tree as kind of part of it. And he's like, okay, yeah, no problem. And he just runs this tree and you can see the limbs come around the inside, the whole thing. But one of my favorite deciduous trees is the maple.
Yeah.
I love the fall colors. It's one of my favorite.
Leaves are badass. Like, it's a whole thing. You don't have to justify liking a maple tree.
You don't. And if you do, well, where are you living? Yeah, you know what I mean? It's a classic tree, very classic tree. So you have this, you know, honoring this concept of a trip with my father that I still have done now twice. I absolutely love the space that it exists in. So there's a lot of symbolism. And then if you get all the way up to the top, right?
Yeah.
You have the owl.
The wise owl.
The wise owl in particular. The owl's name is Darius, just so you know. Okay. Now, can you get why?
For Hooting the Blowfish?
Yeah, there you go. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Barf. Sad that I got that. Hoot.
But you did.
I know.
Okay. The cool part about the eye or about the owl is the eye. If you look at the eye, it has the reflection of the seven trees that are below. Right. And in particular, the owl is the representation of my grandparents that have, you know, passed wisdom, yada, yada, yada. Reflection, you know, all those symbolic things coming through. So the eye, though, is kind of what, I mean, you know, it sells it.
Yeah.
It, like you look at it and you're like, oh, that's pretty BA, you know? So it was a four, but yeah, again, it was a four part whole thing. It took a year and a couple months in those sessions to get through because the way Dylan, you have to schedule out with him, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm a good artist. They're busy.
If you call a tattoo artist and they're like, I'm free anytime.
Yeah.
Probably don't want to work.
Probably.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to bash those artists. There's a niche for everybody. Right. But that wasn't where I was going to go and get very permanent things done.
Yeah.
On my body. So yeah, losing a friend is hard. I will say that, of 30 plus years, it was definitely one of the hardest things that I've ever gone through. And it's actually kind of funny. One of the things that Hannah and I, we were just talking about was, know that I'm an Enneagram 8 and she's a 9.
A what now?
an Enneagram. It's these nine different personality types, ultimately, that we all kind of fit into the box of.
What am I?
I don't know. I don't know them well. Hannah does.
Enneagram.
Yeah, it starts with an E, and then there's like a bunch of A's. It's a lot of vowels. Okay. It's a lot of vowels.
Okay, so you're now an 8?
I'm an 8, and I'm a hard 8.
What the hell does that even mean?
Well, there's a lot of different nuances to every single number or every Enneagram, but in particular, things that exist as part of my life that ultimately are part of the core that will never change. Cause I still, you know, even post divorce, I've grown and changed as a person. But there's these core things that don't change. And one of the things that Hannah had sent me a video about eights was that, the interesting thing about Enneagram eights is that we will trust less than 10 people our entire lives. Like we do not trust people easily. And to give you an idea, I know for a fact that at current, I trust less than 5. There are less than 5 people that are allowed to truly know the everything. You know what I mean?
All the things.
And Ben was certainly, my former friend Ben, he was certainly one of those.
Yeah.
Those individuals that I trusted. And so for Hannah, in learning about the Enneagrams, what she's learning about me, even as her ex-husband, is how to interact with me and those things that make me tick the way that I do. Another really good example is, if you're going to come to me with information or any Enneagram 8, it has to be whole truth the whole way, good or bad. I don't care. It does not matter what the information is. But if I find out that it is not, if there's holes in it, right? If holes exist in the storyline or the logic, I pull back. I won't trust you. We're gone. Yeah. And so for Hannah, the interesting part is that she's a 9. She's a peacemaker, right? Okay. And part of peacemaking also is, well, I don't want to share whole truth because I'm afraid that that's going to rock the boat.
Yeah.
And so,
because you're trying to balance the room. So you have to figure out how to give everybody the pieces that they need instead of giving it.
And so for Hannah, what she is now beginning to understand, and you know, these are things that we learn post divorce, and it's really good and healthy, like really good space. But post divorce, what she's learning is like, this is how I need to interact with Ben because this is what's going to make him feel comfortable. This will get her. She understands that by giving me all the information, it will get her to the peace that she ultimately is searching for as the peacemaker, right? Yeah. I will be much more calm when I'm given all of that information, no matter what.
Is this part of the difficulty that we have sometimes in the world of forgetting to include ourselves as part of the
equation?
Exactly. So she's trying to make, like, as a peacemaker, sometimes you go, all right, I need to make peace with everybody to the detriment of yourself. And for you getting all of the, I need the whole truth. But if you can't give the truth, then you end up betraying yourself. And now you're an internal struggle and all that.
In that internal struggle, right? That's where you start figuring out how you're going to react to certain situations, right? And in particular, one thing that Hannah and I just talked about is some things that are going on in my family on my side, and my mother communicating with Hannah and not with me, because my mother and I are kind of currently at odds, but we're kind of getting to a place where I think that we can start having conversation. So she was bringing me information about a situation that we didn't necessarily have to have a decision on. And for me, I'm the type of person, I want a decision, right? The Enneagram 8, once we have the information, it's boom, we make decisions, right? Yeah. We charge forward with the headstrong speed of the whole thing. It goes. And for me, I have to take that in and then understand that there might not be an actionable item at the end that I have to come to peace with that for myself, that there is no action right now. We're just in this waiting period to see what's what. So really, it, you know, and I've told people this on my lives, for those of you who join my lives, I personally believe that I am blessed with the absolute best ex in the world.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
And she was, you know, she was an amazing wife. She is an amazing mother, and a great human. And as we go through post-divorce things, it's fun for us to both understand how we grow and where we grow, right? But then how that, because we go back to these 16 years of marriage, right? And at one point, Hannah asked me, in conversation, we're talking again about these Enneagram types. And she goes, you know what I think I figured out on how we lasted for 16 years? How we did that? Because we didn't fight. It wasn't fighting. But Enneagrams, or the eights, I need conflict in my life. Right. Like, I am the type of person where I will pick a fight with you over the most mundane detail. Like, I mean,
bring it on. Let's go.
Yeah. Like, I picked these stupid little fights. Yep. And what Hannah started figuring out was that the conflict was necessary. I didn't pick fights to be angry. Yeah. I picked fights for engagement. Right.
Yeah.
And the way that she would handle this as the peacemaker is sarcasm. Our marriage survived on sarcasm for 16 years. I would get my conflict out of the sarcasm that she would dish me, which I love, right? Yeah. Like, I love, and my daughter has that sarcasm. I freaking love it. She throws it right at me. You know, it's the absolute best. But as long as it is respectful, right? Yeah. I have no problem with it. There's always the respect factor, and it's a floating scale, I think. You know, because, you know, sometimes even my daughter, she tests that boundary of.
Well, here's the thing you have to remember is, as you and Hannah try to discover who you are as adult people who have lived a lifetime of things, your children are idiots. they have no idea that. Well, there's no frame of reference for any of this. So they're trying to figure out how the world works. You are trying to figure out how you work in the world as you understand it. They're trying to figure out everything at one time. Like, my wife has a tendency to go, oh, these kids are just driving me crazy, and I think they're doing it on purpose. And I go, they don't have any purpose. What the hell are you talking about purpose? They're five. But that's the funny thing is we put, because, well, we do this all the time where we put our agency into the world where it doesn't belong, right? Like,
sure.
That fucking maple tree saw Lewis and Clark and was that's why it stands so much. Yeah, they don't give a shit about Lewis and Clark. As far as I know, they're just a couple of assholes wandering through the woods. And so, but we put this agency on this tree is so old, and you hear that and you go, oh, I can feel the majesty of it. And you give it these characteristics that, you know, that are human
characteristics, right?
We do that all the time. But I think sometimes we give additional agency to people when they haven't earned it, right? Like we try to, you put yourself in somebody else's shoes. Doesn't mean you've walked their journey. Like you didn't just go, man, these shoes suck. The shoes I have are awesome. But like, it's you have to figure it out. But especially with kids, where you look at it and just go, like I try to pull myself back and go, how much of this is just nature? I'll give you a ridiculous example of this. When I was a child, don't know why I did this. Anytime I had chores that were assigned to me, it was like, hey, it's your turn to clean the kitchen or whatever. And this from the time I was very young, I'd be like, well, I gotta take a 30-minute shit. See you later. I don't know why I did that. I didn't learn it anywhere. And I certainly didn't try to teach it to anybody. But guess what my daughter does when you ask her to do something?
Yeah, I know.
I couldn't tell you why she does that. The fact that it's genetic or whatever, but there's certain traits that your children pick up that you're just kind of born with. Like, you didn't aspire to be an Enneagram 8, whatever the hell that is.
Oh, yeah.
But you're kind of born with it, and there's these certain traits. But the idea that, oh, yeah, that's – they're doing this because they want to – there's – a lot of things we have no choice over.
Absolutely.
But the older you get, you feel like you have control over all your emotions and all your thing, and you don't.
No, you don't.
And your kids don't at all.
Yeah, no, it might not be a control, but it is, I do believe that you can get to a point of awareness of 100%. Where those emotions come from, and a better way to handle those. And my example of that is, I think that many times in my life, I never got physical when I got angry or frustrated. I was never that kind of guy, but I did get loud. I'm a loud, like I will talk
shocked louder. To hear that.
I will talk louder than you. I will use this vocal thing that I have to drown you out. So that I will win that argument. And that's not a safe space. that's not a safe space for anybody. And I really believe that for my kids, this awareness of that is really where I'm beginning to excel best. And I think that our children are also a really good temperature gauge of these things. So back in March of this year, as Hannah and I were approaching a year of divorce.
Congratulations, by the way. Did you celebrate the anniversary?
No. When you say it that way. So
I remember my mom goes, do you know what today is? No idea. She's like, today is the day that your father and I have been divorced now longer than we were married. And they were married for 20 years.
Yeah, long time.
Maybe longer. And then, but they still get along great. And it's interesting. But there's days where, like, all of a sudden everybody's had a few drinks. Mom and dad are sitting next to each other. Everybody's like, woo. And then there's time where it's like, thank God I'm not married to that. For both sides.
And it could be the same day.
Oh, like, it could be the same 30 minutes. Give me a break.
Right.
But yeah, it's just.
So I'm sitting on the couch with my daughter, Peyton. TV's on. And
after Peyton Pritchard. No?
No, not even close. So I'm on the couch with Peyton. My son, 8 years or about, he's seven at the time. He's about to turn eight.
Yep.
He's in the bathroom. Number two, right?
Just said taking a shit like 2 minutes.
You're ago. Right.
Okay. So dropping the kids off at the pool.
Right.
Cutting rope.
He's doing that thing that children of that age do where they leave the door open. What is that? Like, why? But okay. So,
well, because if you need help, you don't want any resistance.
Exactly. Get in here now. I don't need this door in the way. Get in here now. So all of a sudden I have this concept question come to my mind. And I think in the moment it was based on some awareness of emotions that I was having. And I asked my daughter, right, Peyton, I turned to her, I said, do you feel now that mom and dad are about to be a year divorced, do you feel like that dad is much more calm and just less stressed in general? And as I finished the question, my son from the bathroom, he comes over and he didn't come over, but he's from the bathroom. He says, oh yeah, yeah, way less stressed. Right. And I, again, going back to the kids and the things that they perceive, right, is very important, because the way my daughter explained it, because the next question I had was, well, do you feel that mom is more calm and less stressed? And again, Hannah and I, we did not have big arguments. Like, we did not. And if we did, we weren't afraid to fight in front of the kids. That was fine. Didn't bother us at all. But
they take the corners.
There was just
kind of rubbing your shoulder. Get in there.
There was always this like stress tension, you know, of just being around each other. And the way that my daughter explained it was that if both you and mom at any given time were at a 10 on a 10 of 10 scale, or one through 10 scale, you're both at a 10 on stress. Dad, you moved to a 1, mom moved to a 5. And that's where you've stayed now post-divorce. There might be things that agitate you the same way they would agitate you. Like, I don't like a lot of clutter. I'm not a big clutter guy in general.
Yeah.
So those things would get underneath my skin a bit and I would typically just boom, blow up. Right. So
get all stuff out of my way.
Yeah. And I just start throwing stuff away. I'm just throwing it away. So there's things like that, that all of a sudden you become more aware of, and the kids and their perception of those things is very important, because I think it's really good to do temperature checks too. It's like, hey, you know, what are you seeing? Like these kids, I think that the other thing, you know, that we always bash screen time and those types of things, but everything in moderation. And I think that our kids, they pick up on so many informational things come to them that you could argue that they are more emotionally advanced than I was at that age because of the things that they're engaging with. Whether they know how to handle the emotion, I don't know, right? But the things that they're being presented with on an emotional scale, they might be too much, right? But I think that the things that they're engaging with are a lot heavier than the things that I was dealing with at the same age.
Well, I think better children have less stigma around topics. So if you bring it up, and it's probably just a more of trying to think of how to put this correctly. It's just probably more of the environment thing. You present it to your children in a different way. I don't know that necessarily screen time or education, like there's certainly more conversations that we have, but there's just fewer barriers to bringing a concept to kids. And then what we do is, because like I said, they have to learn a lot of this behavior that is ingrained. They're growing up in a very different environment than we did with the technology and everything that's around, but we still played video games and did all that and had, you know, different conversations. But it's, to me, it just feels like there's fewer taboos. Mm-hmm. And it's the reason your son takes a crap with the door open is because he doesn't know he's supposed to be ashamed of taking a dump yet. You know, he doesn't know that he needs to hide it. He's not trying to impress anybody because he doesn't know he needs to. He's like my daughter. One of my daughters will, can you come light a match in here? It stinks. She's not wrong. She's like, that smells a little bit like fire, but it does smell better. And I'm like, you're welcome. And I don't like, they'll run, you know, two kids running around the house buck naked, just being, you know, crazy, getting ready for bath time, shaking their butts, doing the whole thing. Like my wife is like, oh God, they can't do that. They'll do this. They're doing this now. They'll do it forever. No, they won't.
No, they won't.
But it's like, there's two different ways you can do it. Is you can be like, these kids are emotional, we have to protect them from it. Or these kids are emotional, let's put our arms around it and go, all right, how do we, you know, like
race.
This is just a guess. You and I are probably slightly more evolved than our parents were when it comes to speaking about our emotions.
Absolutely.
That's not universal. There's people that I've met in my life and I was like, well, your parents talked about that. And it gives us the idea. And hopefully our kids will be more, you know, socially adept than we were. But I don't know that it's necessarily a generational thing as much as it is, you know, just we grew up like rednecks.
Yeah. Got you.
You know, that's part of it. But I just think for at least what I'm noticing is going, man, these kids have fewer barriers. But then there's also the, you know, the constant struggle where there's probably more kids that are being suppressed that way because we don't want them to turn out like all these Fruit Loops that are out there and do, you know, it's like there are people that will take that extra hard right or left, depending on where they think that their kids are getting too soft or getting any of this. So the thing that's good about having access to social media and seeing what people are going on is it shows you more of human culture, right? You have access. You can go and see what's going on the other side of the world.
Absolutely.
But you can go, all right, let me find the things that I appreciate and embrace about this, or let me find more people that are against this, and I can find that same echo chamber, and I can create an environment that actually goes in a stark contrast to that. My mom always said that her parenting philosophy was the exact opposite of what her parents did. She had a rough childhood, and she had nine kids in her family or whatever. I spent plenty of time around her family. I know she didn't do everything the opposite, but she tried to make sure that she was, you know, more willing to let us go out and make our own mistakes and do all of that. And she certainly didn't rule with an iron fist. Her dad did. And so, you know, you try to take the things that were difficult for you and do them the opposite. But my childhood was better than my mom. So I'm like, what are the good things? What are the bad things? What are the things that, you know, we can do differently? And at some point you see the story of, you know, the billionaire mogul's son, the self-made man has kids and they become inept because they had everything handed to them. And they, you know, from an outside perspective, we look at them and go, what an abject failure. You know, this person was as a parent. Could have been a million things that led to that. But what we see is the things that we don't have. Well, they have money, so I don't want to have too much money because my kids are going to be terrible. It's like plenty of rich kids that grow up just fine and get great education and go on to carry the torch. But we see it because we're always kind of drawn to disaster a little bit, right? So we go and look at these people and go, wow, I'm not doing what they did because this person turned out like that. But you can pick apart the things that you don't like, and there's something that will validate your story. You find the things that you do like, and there's things that will validate your story. So the bigger problem to me with the over-connected world isn't that there's too much information out there. It's that our brains process intentionally the things that we're selecting for. Sure. You know what I mean? Like the things that you notice, you know, when you look at a landscape or whatever. So, you know, it's you go and you sit at the top of a mountain, go out to Eastern Oregon, you sit at the top of the mountain, you're going to notice different things than I notice, than somebody else notices, right? You take somebody that's never been to Eastern Oregon, they're just going to sit there and take in the whole thing, the totalitarianism of the whole thing, and just be like, dude, look at the vastness of it. You're going to be like, dude, I'll bet you that canyon is great for grouse and pheasants and whatever else. And I'm going to look at it. And, you know, it's just, we all perceive things through through our experience. So it's just,
I had a friend of mine, communicate that concept you're talking about there. When for me to take people outdoors with me, right?
Yeah.
For me, it's very much an experience. I want you to engage and enjoy the outdoors the way I do. And my goal when I take people out is to show you what that is for me. And the lady that told me this was like, you know, if you go out to the woods and you're sitting in at a underneath the moon and it's a lake, you're going to look at the moon. The people that go with you are going to look at that moon, look at that lake and the reflection, and they're going to say, oh, that's so pretty. The way I digest it is I look at the ripples of the water. There's this underlying detail that exists for me. And if you go read my journals, like these are the things I talk about. It is very minute things where I'm looking at rocks, not the landscape of all the rocks. I'm looking at individual rocks, what they are, why they're there. And I have this drive to know everything, you know, like it's fascinating to me because there's people that I talk to. You know, I just got a couple of things I did this last weekend, which were super fun. Went sage grouse hunting. And on Monday, I was out salmon fishing.
Yeah.
In particular, what I want to talk about here is the concept of vastness, right? So there are people that will look at the universe, the galaxy, the Milky Way, and they see this vastness and they get overwhelmed at the concept of all that could be out there, right? That vastness of, And it's this daunting, scary thing for them. And similarly, the ocean can do the same thing, where it's this vastness of, we don't know what's there always, right? And because it is so big and so vast, it scares them. Like to the degree that Hannah is terrified of whales. She will never go to the ocean.
Really?
She has an absolute... She's petrified of it, right? Getting knocked over by a whale.
Check out the video of the whale. There's a humpback whale that eats a whole kayak. Did you see that?
Worst nightmare.
For her. Geez.
Right.
And everything's fine.
Yeah. It's good to go. Dude, everything's fine.
Come on.
So the interesting part for me is that I find great comfort in the concepts of the galaxy and the universe, the vastness of the ocean. And the reason that I've started to kind of pinpoint why that is, why I'm so comfortable.
It's because you're Nate.
What's that?
Because you're Nate.
No, what it is it is the concept that everything that is out there knows more than I do. And I want to know what they know.
Yeah.
Whether that is the whale, the fish, what they've seen, the things that they have seen and know are greater than what I know. And for some reason, my curiosity is greater, a greater emotion than fear. So I would travel to the depths of the ocean to go get that information. And another example of this is back when Hannah and I were married, we did a live and we did this thing where it was a game. It's called Hypotheticals. And it puts you in these situations where what would you choose to do? And like one of these concepts was you can be given $20,000 to go on any vacation you ever wanted to on the world, mm-hmm. on Earth.
Yep.
And it's like a 7-day trip, right? Or you could travel to the moon. You would land for 30 minutes, bounce around on the moon. And you have to come back.
Okay.
Right. Which would you choose? For me, it's the moon. I am going to the moon, right?
Sure.
Like it's just, I want to know more. So I'm going to the moon. I can do this vacation on Earth. I know the things I want to know here right now. I want to go to the moon. And for Hannah, it was the complete opposite, right? And it fascinating. Yeah. And so we had this debate happening in real time, team moon or team Earth, right? Where would we go? And I think we were going to make a shirt at one point because at one point I'm getting not angry, but in jest.
You're getting loud. That's loud. What you do, Ben.
It is what I do.
Don't drown me out. My position is valid too.
And I was doing this thing where like,
I couldn't even do that without getting loud. I should have done that a little. I should have done that softer. Damn it. Good. I wasn't good, Hannah. I mean, I've never met her. So I guess,
but that vastness concept, I just,
So here's the thing that I think. So we went, I took my daughters fishing, my brothers and my dad, my sister, their kids are a little bit older. They went into this campground that we used to go to when we were kids. And it's a pretty steep descent, hike into a creek canyon, hike down to, there's a little nice swimming hole on there. And we had this campground set up when we were kids. And I brought my kids up the next day. They're a little young to be packing in their body weight in camping gear, and they need a little bit more and whatever. And I don't want to carry it all, plus them, plus the whole thing. So
yep.
We just go in just for a day of fishing, and we go down there, and I'm picturing this, and you're talking about looking at like the individual rocks and stuff. The other thing, though, that I realized is when I go to that spot, we went every summer for probably 10 straight years when I was a kid and when we were all big enough to, you know, hike in all of this gear and stuff. And we brought in so much crap down to the bottom of this canyon, drug it all out. Most of it was, you know, just beer for my dad. So it was all gone by the time we went out. But anyway, so we go down there and watching it through the kids' eyes, they're seeing it kind of for the first time. My nieces and nephews have been there, you know, dozen times or whatever, or spend enough time there. But for me, I look at it and look for the changes. Look for, like, I see the memories. I see me and my brothers, you know, swimming across and jumping off the rocks on the other side. I see all the time that we spent just skipping rocks down the creek. But then I noticed that, like, you know, over 2 decades of winters, things have shifted a little bit. You know, these giant boulders that seem immovable, that seem like these giant feats of the kids going halfway across the stream to go and sit on what they now call Cousin Rock because they can fit all 6 of the cousins on the rock. And, you know, we went down with one of my cousins, I think, a few times, but it was, you know, it's Cousin Rock now to them, but they're seeing it through their own eyes. And you don't want to take that away. You don't want to go, let me tell you all about the thing. You can just see where the little path of a creek has now changed and done all of that. But the other thing that you do, and this kind of happened yesterday, I went and played golf with one of my best friends from, we played T-ball together. Another friend of mine that they'd never met. And I was trying to pick a golf course that was convenient for everybody. And I was like, let's play over at, we went to Heron Lakes and we played the Greenback. And I haven't played there in probably since high school that I can remember, where like actually going and playing full 18 on that course. And so I was like, let's play this one. It's just been a long time. And I couldn't remember all of the change, but every time you get to a hole, I'm like, oh yeah, this, now it's kind of kicking in because we played it a bunch. But you go out and you do these things that feel really repetitive, fishing, hunting, you're kind of doing the same thing all the time, but golf is endlessly this way. Yeah. And I played through the front nine and I didn't play particularly well, but you know, one of those feats when you're a 20 handicap is that I'm playing with one golf ball the whole way through. And I'm like, that's pretty good. Like, you know, yeah. had a couple you nice shots, didn't lose a golf ball. First shot on the back nine. Slice the drive right over into a big group of trees, tons of falling leaves because it's a fall, which is not great for golf. And then they have like their little compost pile. And I'm like, man, I went right towards this. It stinks. I'm not looking for it. And I'm like, screw it. I'm not playing that well anyway. Drop a ball, chuck it up on the fairway. It's a par five. And so I'm one into the woods, two out, three up to the fairway. I'm sitting 104 yards out. And it's just, it's all of this routine, right? But I grab my 104 yard club, line it up, hit it up there. Nobody's looking. I go, I think it hit the stick. The other guy looks up. He goes, I don't see it on the green. Maybe it went in. Get up there. It's sitting in the hole. And I sink it from 104 yards. It was three holes before I calmed down from it. I'm like, dude, that's sweet. But you right? catch that big fish. Even if you don't get it, you see that giant buck that goes running across. You have these things that we all do. Like, dude, you can watch 100 football games and not have a Hail Mary, but that just the possibility of it. And what happens is that the more you experience something, the more things that you expect to anticipate. And I've used this example a million times, but a bunch of people think baseball's boring. Totally get it. But I grew up playing baseball. I've watched enough baseball that I always imagine the scenario. Imagine going into the eighth inning of a baseball game and you're sitting there and it's live. And both pitchers are throwing a perfect game. I just bring up that scenario, and every time I mention it, dude, the hair on the back of my arm stands up, just being like, dude, that would be awesome.
Yeah. Somebody's got to lose. But somebody has to not. Yeah.
Imagine that being your first baseball game you ever went to.
Oh, yeah. The expectation moving forward, right?
No. This is the first baseball game you've ever been to. You don't really know how the game works. All you know is these two guys keep going up there and throwing it. Nobody's gotten a hit. Nobody's been on base. Yeah. Nobody's like, it would just be like, and you're so like, what's the object of this thing? Well, he throws it. They try to hit it and then you get on base. And then when they get on base, that's when it gets really exciting. Cause then you have the steal and all this, whatever. Like you get to the eighth inning. First of all, the game would be flying by, which would probably be a good thing for it. But then you just go, you have to understand, like this never happens or whatever. Like, it's like trying to explain why something amazing.
Absolutely.
Like so my sister on her 21st birthday, she wants to play craps. She's like, I don't know how to play craps. And I lived in Vegas at the time. And she gets down there and I'm like, all right, well, just grab like $100 or whatever. And we'll throw it down on this table. It's a $5 minimum bet. And I'll show you to replace it. And she's like, what's the minimum? And I go, well, it's $5, but you'll need more than that. She's like, can I just start with five? Yeah. I go, yeah, I guess so. Whatever. So she puts it on the come out line. And so we roll and seven, she wins. She's like, this is great. Yeah. And then I was rolling and she's standing to my left. I'm showing her how to do it. I rolled for like 12 minutes.
Ooh, and so you're in a heater.
Dude, I ended up winning like $400 on the roll. And she ended up winning like 100 because she didn't like every time I'm like, oh, well now move your bet here, whatever. But she started from $5. And she's like, this is amazing. She's like, you're so good at this. And I'm like, all right, you're rolling. She's like, what? I'm not rolling. I just won $100. Like, this is the best night of my life. I think it's the only time she's ever played craps. I think it's the only time she's ever played craps.
Yep.
And the first time I taught my wife how to play craps, because my wife grew up in Vegas, but she moved away when she was like 19 or 20. She moved back and then we started dating. And she's like, I never learned how to play any of these games. So we go to play craps the first time. Played. We ran out of the table and everybody crapped out on like the first or second roll. And we lost that $100 in like seven rolls. And it was just absolutely ridiculous. We go over to play roulette and she just starts winning right away. She will never play craps again. And she will always play roulette. It's just but it's these, it's you create enough scenarios that if you go and the first time is amazing, you go back and you may never hit that height again, but it's that the expectations and and you go and you sit at that lake or whatever the scenario that you have. And if you're free of expectation, man, you're creating things in your mind. And now you're looking at the deep, dark woods and the vastness or the ocean or whatever. There's a reason they created all these monsters. There's a reason there's Loch Ness and Sasquatch and mermaids and, you know, whatever, and the Kraken and all of that and space aliens. It's because you sit there and you stare. And if you don't have any expectation, what can you do but create stories?
Yeah, create the let the imagination run.
And somebody tells a good story. Next thing you know, it's like you're repeating. Well, here's what I heard. You play that telephone game. Next thing you know, it's like you go out there. It's like, sure, but do you want a giant squid tentacle up your a-hole? I'm not going near the ocean.
Well, and like going back to that concept of the expectation, like I will pretty much watch Aaron Rodgers. Go for in the fourth quarter.
Yep.
If he's down, I'm at a point now where I expect a Hail Mary.
Oh, yeah. Unless like it's in the playoffs because he's going to choke.
Yeah. Well, no, not playoffs.
Yeah, regular season, though. He's great.
Yeah. But if it's regular season, he's going to make that Hail Mary throw and it might just get caught.
Yeah. Well, I was watching the Beastquake game, the Marshawn Lynch running over the Saints in the playoffs. They're 7-9 and the Saints are the favorite, but they're the road team because the division, whatever.
Yeah.
And I was at my in-laws and nobody watches football. And so slowly people were like coming into the room and I'm explaining, like I'm setting up the scenario and everybody's like, whatever. And slowly like a little crowd starts forming. There's questions coming at me and I'm explaining how football works to everybody. And then dude just mows over all these people. And dude, by the end of the game, we had a ton of football fans and they're like, that was unbelievable. I'm like, you don't even know how unbelievable that was. I'm standing on the couch and whatever. So it's like even if you go and you get that experience the first time, you never have that excitement of like, you don't know how many times I've watched this happen. It doesn't work like this. And you end up feeding off of somebody else's energy, but then you're never going to get that again too. So it's good and bad if you get that perfect experience the first time out.
Absolutely. Well, okay. I'll give you one. So first time experience, I know we're about done here.
Yeah. We'll wrap first it up. We'll wrap it up with this, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. First time experience this last weekend. I did something for the first time that I've never done before in the state of Oregon. And I got to hunt an animal that I've never hunted before. And it was super fun. It was
nutria?
Sage grouse. Saw
about 40 nutria on the golf course yesterday. Just everywhere, man. Just go up and smack them with a 9-iron.
The cool part about sage, there's cool parts, there's uncool parts. The thing that I love about what the sage grouse is they are ultimately currently a survival story.
They're also Enneagram 8.
Don't start.
Oh, sorry. All of them. Every single sage.
Every single one of them. I read it. But so these birds, right? They're actually a very fragile bird. And it's because the reason they're fragile is because the environment that they exist in.
You're chasing them with a shotgun.
Yeah, I know. Okay. But again, we realized after we got done hunting why they have such regulation on this particular bird. Yeah. And so the way that this hunt would end up going, my dad and I were out in the deep southeast of Oregon, because I have drawn a mule deer tag for this year.
Nice.
And it's an area that I haven't been to. And so we wanted to go scout it. As part of the scouting opportunity, we're like, well, heck, we can put in for a sage grouse tag in the same area and give us a reason to have a shotgun in our hands as we're just touring the grounds. Totally. Right.
Yeah. My brother does turkey hunting for the same reason.
Exactly. So we get out there and, you know, dad and I, we find a reservoir that does have water. The name of the game in the high desert is find water and you're going to find animals. That's how it goes. So we find some water and dad and I, we get up in the morning, just have coffee. Literally, we have shotguns in one hand and coffee mug in the other. And we're just walking around in the wood or in the sage.
Yep.
I end up getting a couple of bunnies that morning, that I wanted a couple of bunnies. I was looking for a bunny meal anyway.
Yeah.
So that goes down. And then my dad, fires a shot from the other sides of these trees. And he comes over the radio and he's like, found birds, you know, he didn't get any, but he's got these found birds. These birds they live in coveys, especially broods when we're coming out of their nesting period. So you have young birds still with the mom, and sometimes the males or the cockbirds, they will just hang around the group. So dad kicks this group of birds up. Their first flight away, they take off probably half a mile to three quarters of a mile, but you can see them across the stage. You see where they're landing, and it's not, you can see that far. So we get done with coffee and we let them sit for about 30, 45 minutes and we go make a hunt on them doing what most hunters would call a classic pincer move, right?
Sure, yeah.
We surrounded and I end up getting a bird out of that group. And it was so I knock it down on the wing. It was great, great experience. And in that morning, so I've got two or three rabbits and I've got a bird. This has been a great morning. We're now going to go, scout for some deer, deer territory, do our thing. And then we get back, we do the scouting, we see some great country, pick some spots that I'm going to hunt. But we get back that night, back to where we ultimately had camped that morning. And because it was the only water that we found the entire day. So we were like, okay, well, we still have three more tags to fill on these sage grouse. And my dad, he's like, these birds, when I jumped them up, we had walked out for about an hour. And then dad was walking back to the truck and he jumped them off the water. So in the hour that we were gone away from this water, these birds had flown in, gotten water, and were there, just feeding and getting water in the morning. So my dad that night, he's like, I think we should just sit on the water and just wait for them to come in, have a cup of coffee, and just screw this walking around, beating our feet up. Meanwhile, our dog's pads are pretty tore up. They're hurting. So I was like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. So we get up in the morning, get our coffee. Literally, I have video, and I'll send it to you later. I have video, and I'm sitting on the right, dad's sitting on the left. We sit there for 45 minutes and no joke, here come five absolutely gorgeous cockbirds. So, and for those of you that don't know, the sage grouse is the one that has the white chest and they balloon these air sacs up that turn yellow when they're mating. And they make this, it's this thumping sound. Like it's a whoop, 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 whoop. Yep. Anyway, so there, and when you see a bird that is a mature bird, you can tell the difference between that and a immature bird very easily. Yep. It is a stark difference in size, in color. And so these birds, on the video, you see my dad, he's like, here they come. And sure enough, on a line, as if we're just sitting in a duck blind, here come these sage grouse just beelining for us. And then I come to the right and I'm like, take them. And just make the call. And you see these three birds go down in front of us. You see my dog go down and, barrel roll one of them and get it back up to us. But it was all this action. This is our first hunt ever.
Yeah.
Right. And it just went off the exact way we wanted it to happen. We get a limit of birds. We didn't have to walk but 50 yards from the truck camp. It was absolutely perfect. But the expectation now is that. Right. It is like, if it is not that from now on, this is a failure of a trip. We had to work too damn hard for these birds. It sucks. But it is too funny how we set that expectation based on our first experiences with anything in this world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the way it works. The first podcast we did was great and we've just been failing since then. But if you want to go back and listen to any of these podcasts, the How To Podcast with Luke and Ben is available on Odyssey.com. Follow Ben on his social medias. Listen to my radio show on 1080 The Fan and get more content from us if you want.
Absolutely.
Cool. We'll see you all. All right, Ben. I got to get running. Thank you, sir.
Have a good day.
You too.